At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Think about this for the next 30 seconds or so. What do you suppose would happen if the Federal Reserve tried to get $1 trillion into the economy and it couldn't find any takers? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Today is Friday, the 20th of March. Good to have you here. And we will understand totally if this escaped you in the rush to the weekend, but the TALF is officially underway. That's the Temporary Asset-Backed Loan Facility, of course, the program where the Fed's going to lend money to investors to help them buy asset-backed securities, specifically things like auto loans, student loans, and credit cards, and so hopefully get the credit markets working again. Yesterday, the Fed tried to give away $200 billion of what the central bank says could eventually be $1 trillion. They only managed to unload a small fraction of it in actual practice. But if investors do start to show up, there are some companies in position to make a whole lot of money. Companies that aren't exactly blameless when it comes to explaining how we got into this mess in the first place. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story now from New York.
To get TALF funds, you've got to have an asset-backed security. So someone's got to wrap all that credit card or student loan debt into a nice package. And guess who does that? The big banks like Citigroup and Goldman Sachs. In fact, says Tony Crescenzi, chief bond market strategist with Miller Tabak,
an investor can't invest directly in the TALF unless they go through, as the Fed requires, a primary dealer, which are the big banks that deal directly with the Fed.
Those banks will collect a fee for their service, and there are a lot more fees down the line, says Reid Auerbach, a lawyer who's working on some TALF deals.
Obviously, the custodian who's acting on behalf of the Fed and taking possession of the collateral. You need underwriters to underwrite the bonds. There are trustees that get fees on the underlying deals.
And, of course, there are the lawyers. But before the Fed agrees to lend, the security has to be rated AAA by two of the three big rating agencies, names you might recognize from the mortgage meltdown, like Moody's and Standard & Poor's. The rating agency fees alone could add up to more than $1 billion. So does this mean the folks who got us into this mess will get paid to get us out?
It's not a happy story.
NYU economist Lawrence White says it's ironic, but not surprising.
Bond markets need help, and the markets are going to pay for that help.
Potentially enriching some infamous Wall Street players yet again. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Speaking of which, those infamous Wall Street players, we are now almost a week into the uproar over that $165 million in extra payouts at AIG. Last night, the House passed a bill to tax away 90% of big bonuses for executives in companies that got bailout money. The Senate and the president still have to be convinced, but Marketplace's Steve Henn reports that not everybody is sure taxing bonuses is the smart thing to do.
Last night, Jay Leno said this AIG thing spooked him.
And the part that scares me is, you're a good guy. If the government decides they don't like a guy,
yeah,
all of a sudden, hey, we're going to tax you, and they boom, and it passes. I mean, that seems a little scary as a taxpayer. They can just decide.
Some tax experts agree.
I don't think this is the appropriate way to handle this.
David K. Johnson is a tax expert and author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. He's no fan of corporations.
But the public really ought to focus on not the $165 million in bonuses, but the $173 billion in bailout to AIG and ask, why don't we just let them go to bankruptcy?
If it's any consolation, this country's had this argument before.
In the 1930s, the federal government was bailing out a lot of corporations, including large insurance companies.
Joseph Thorndike's a tax historian. Back then, Congress worried executives would make a killing, so they thought about taxing their income.
What they eventually decided was that the taxes were just impractical. It would be too hard to tailor a tax that narrowly.
Sound familiar? Today, bankers are arguing the bonus tax could kill the bank bailout, and a 90% tax rate is outrageous. But there's precedent for that, too. The highest U.S. tax rate was 91% for all top earners, from World War II until the 60s. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Having spent 12 of the past 36 hours sitting on airplanes, I can tell you that this recession is not keeping people from flying. There wasn't an empty seat to be had on any of the flights I was on. Fears of what might happen, though, as travelers start thinking about staying home in a recession, sparked an airline industry price war. Normally, that would lead to lower profits, no matter what the industry. But Tamara Keith reports those super low fares aren't beating up airlines as much as you might think.
Southwest Airlines blasted off this email early Thursday morning. Huge sale, tiny prices. They lowered their summer fares to as little as $49 one way to lots of U.S. cities. And most other airlines are busy matching them.
It's just some of the craziest prices I've ever seen.
Rick Sini is CEO of FareCompare.com. He says summer is typically the most expensive time to fly, not this year.
This is the kind of pricing that's going to get a lot of people off their couches and onto their computers and booking tickets. It's unbelievable pricing.
Getting people off their couches is exactly what the airlines need to do. According to the Air Transport Association, passenger and cargo demand has dropped sharply thanks to the recession. John Heimlich is the association's chief economist. He says this comes just as the airlines were finally catching their breath after last year's devastatingly high fuel prices.
Obviously, we can't have our cake and eat it too, because as soon as fuel prices drop, revenue falls off a cliff.
High fuel prices had already forced a huge cutback in flights, so the airline industry was well positioned for the recession. Now that fuel is cheaper, Heimlich says airlines can afford to cut fares to fill remaining seats.
If we'd seen this kind of level of demand with last year's fuel prices, forget it. You'd be seeing cuts in capacity that would be sharply more dramatic than what you're seeing right now.
So if you can afford it, it's a great time to fly. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Tamara mentioned fuel prices. I promise you the airline folks who are in charge of paying the gas bills have been keeping a close eye on oil this week. It dipped just a little bit today, but still closed above $51 a barrel. And those relatively weak nibbles at the first slice of TALF money didn't exactly set things rolling on Wall Street either. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We've all been paying a lot of attention to the monthly unemployment rate, 8.1% at the moment. But that is obviously not the only thing the Labor Department tracks. They gave us another snapshot today of how deep this recession is getting. The monthly mass layoff report came out this morning. That's more than 50 people being cut from any one company. There were, the department says, almost 3,000 mass layoff actions, they call it last month, putting 300,000 people out of work. With fewer people, big companies aren't so hungry for new office space. And that's a reality that's playing out on the streets of Baltimore, Maryland. The recession is holding up a project to turn one of that city's toughest neighborhoods into a hub for biotechnology. Kathy Duchamp reports.
If you want to see neglect, come to East Baltimore. Plywood covers the windows and doors of old brick row houses. Weeds and stray cats occupy empty lots. People hang out on grimy marble stoops. But change is coming. Jack Shannon leads me on a tour of what he calls the new East Baltimore.
Taking these vacant, derelict, in some cases lead-contaminated properties and turning them into sustainable, energy-efficient homeownership opportunities.
Shannon is in charge of a nonprofit that plans to turn this neighborhood of last resort into a national model for urban redevelopment.
If we slog away at this together, we actually can create something that offers long-time residents the opportunity to stay here if they desire, and at the same time, newcomers to take part in a green, thriving community right in the heart of the city.
Picture a campus with new offices and apartments, renovated townhouses, and a big park. The economic engine of the development, a biotech hub next to the Johns Hopkins Medical Campus. It's supposed to create thousands of jobs. But almost half the labs sit empty, idled by the recession.
The challenge now is to ride out the storm, get over the valley of death.
Scott Levitan is in charge of leasing biotech office space for his real estate company, Forest City. Levitan says this public-private deal was big and complicated even before the recession. It has a $1.8 billion budget. But Levitan was confident, at least at first.
When I came to Baltimore, you know, and I moved here in 2006, I thought I was going to do five leases in the building and that it would be full.
Levitan says the credit crunch broke the business model for the biotech park. Forest City bet on attracting big pharmaceutical companies, but the firms have scaled back scientific research. Instead, they're buying up smaller companies with drugs already in the pipeline. So Levitan is stuck trying to recruit biotech startups, many that are just struggling to survive. It's forced Levitan and Forest City to take the long view.
We're probably not going to make a killing on this first building, but we'll do fine. Let's get the market. Let's establish ourselves.
It's not just developers who feel stuck. Longtime East Baltimore residents say promises have been broken.
The insecurity of not knowing who's holding your life in their hands, living in limbo for so long.
Donald Gresham bought a row house in East Baltimore 20 years ago after living on the streets. But he gave up the keys to his home a few weeks back. It's slated for demolition to make way for a new charter school where the kids of all those biotech workers would go. Gresham's been promised a rehabbed home in the neighborhood. Problem is, those rehabs aren't ready. The developer says because banks aren't making construction loans. Gresham doesn't believe it.
Oh, I feel like I'm homeless again. I really did. That experience with not knowing that I can never go back to my home again, it hurts. It's very painful for me.
Developers say relocated homeowners were paid on average $160,000, a lot more than their homes were worth. Scott Levitan says investors remain committed to building a new East Baltimore.
Our company has $47 million of equity in this project, and the city, the state, the philanthropic organizations have another $120 million invested in it. And so...
You're not walking away.
No, we're not.
A nervous laugh about an ambitious project trying to tough out the recession. In Baltimore, I'm Kathy Duchamp for Marketplace.
There was a whole lot of the political mixed in with the economic this week. It actually started, truth be told, at the end of last week with the news that AIG was going to pay out $165 million taxpayer dollars in executive bonuses. To help us do our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond, we have turned once again to Heidi Moore. She's the lead writer for the Deal Journal blog at the Wall Street Journal. John Carney writes for ClusterStock.com. Welcome back, guys.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
John, we're going to start with you, and we're going to start with AIG. And the question is, was it distraction, or is there actually something there to be discussed?
It's a little bit of both. It's distraction in that it has everybody focused on something that's a relatively minor issue in terms of the health of our economy, but it really actually does matter because it's a dramatic illustration of what we're doing wrong by having the government keep alive failing institutions.
Heidi, I want your take on whether it's a distraction or whether there's something really to be discussed about these bonuses.
No, I think it is firmly a distraction. These are 73 people who made bonuses over $1 million. And this country is dealing with a two-year-long recession, the freeze of credit, the fall of the automakers. Our problems are so much bigger than these people's bonuses. And I just think this looks like a populist circus.
All right, well, let me crib a line from Paul Krugman here and throw this at you, Heidi. He says, you know, the problem with these bonuses and not making a stink about them is that it shows we continue to have faith in those who got us into this mess in the first place.
I think that's a little bit convenient to say because it assumes that the same people who are getting these bonuses somehow in their free time plotted the downfall of the entire economy. And that really wasn't the case. These were people who were professional gamblers. Their job was to make bets on obscure financial products, and it was eminently visible from the very moment that they started their job in 2006 or 2005 that losing that money was going to be a potential outcome.
Well, somebody blew it, though, right, John?
Absolutely. I think that there is a huge, outrageous thing to say that these guys, as Heidi said, are professional gamblers, and now we have to take their losses. Rewarding people who took outrageous risks, put the taxpayers on the hook for their losses, and then actually paying them their salaries so they can live in their Connecticut mansions, I think is just something that was bound to provoke outrage, and the managers at AIG should have known it, and frankly, so should have the people in the Treasury Department who were supposed to be overseeing a company that the public now owns 80% of.
Congress is channeling its outrage that you guys have been talking about into getting some of that money back. The House passed that 90% tax last night. The Senate's going to take it up next week. Heidi, what do you think?
I think it's absolutely absurd. I mean, first of all, it creates so many troubling precedents. Number one, it is, you know, if the Congress can go out there and just penalize anybody's bonuses, what if they decide that journalists aren't serving the public interest enough and they, you know, tax my piddling little salary at, you know, 90% or something like that? It's so arbitrary and it's retroactive, which is incredibly dangerous. And, you know, then you have people leaving Wall Street. If you want banks to pay off their TARP money, they're going to need some employees to do some work. But who's going to go into work knowing that they're basically going into work to pay off the government?
I have to agree with Heidi. I don't think that it's realistic to put a 90% tax on a bonus. People just won't work for it.
Let me try to back the discussion up a little bit and try to maybe put this in a little bit of context. One of the things I was thinking about the other day was the mad rush that we were all in September and October, and when I say we, I mean Congress, to do something. Because Bernanke and Paulson, the Treasury Secretary and the Chairman of the Fed, were saying, the world's going to end if you don't do something. Shouldn't we sort of frame what's going on now in light of the press and the squeeze that was on back then? Heidi?
Yeah, you know, I think we should, actually. Goldman Sachs held a conference call just today to explain its exposures to AIG. And one of the themes that came out was how fearful they were of systemic risk if AIG fell in September. But you have to understand that this $85 billion loan that we're stuck with and saddled with and probably never going to figure out, that was signed in 2 days. That's $85 billion in 2 days. And the fact that it doesn't include a lot of sophisticated thinking shouldn't be a surprise.
Heidi Moore is the lead writer for the Wall Street Journal's Deal Journal blog. John Carney writes for ClusterStock.com. Thanks to you both, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, conversations from a Go Green Expo.
This could be the green revolution. This could be a pivotal point where we actually make a stand against those naysayers that say, of course, global warming is a myth.
But first, let's do the numbers. Bearish buzz helped push the Dow Industrials down 122 points today. That's a loss of 1 2/3%. Ended the week at 7,278. The NASDAQ dropped 26 points, 1 3/4%, closed at 1,457. The S&P 500 declined 15 points, almost 2%, wrapped up trading at 768. In spite of today's number, stocks gained for a second straight week. I can't think of the last time that happened. The Dow recovered nearly 0.75% Monday through Friday. The NASDAQ bounced 1 3/4%. The S&P 500 climbed 1.5% since Monday. Analysts put their imagination to work with GE and cut their earnings expectations. General Electric was the biggest weight on the Dow today. The stock sagged almost 6%. There was also disappointment in the number of investors signing up for the Fed's program to boost small business and consumer lending. That'd be the TALF we were telling you about. It was partly to blame for a decline in financial shares. Wells Fargo stock pulled in the reins by almost 9.25%. J.P. Morgan Chase fell back nearly 7.25%. Bond prices edged lower, lifting the yield on the 10-year T-note to 2.64%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
American Public Media presents Repossessing Virtue. Engage with wise voices on the economic downturn from moral and ethical perspectives at speakingoffaith.org. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link. Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for February. It's World Meteorological Day. The theme this year, weather, climate, and the air we breathe. And automaker Tata launches its Nano in Mumbai. Hyped as the world's cheapest car, it will be available in standard and deluxe versions. Tata Motors will start taking orders in April. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. State governors might want to clue into that mass layoff number I mentioned earlier. Unemployment claims are still going up. Several states are going to have to pass legislation soon to extend benefits to keep checks going to 500,000 laid-off workers. And meanwhile, the feds also want to give states money to help modernize their unemployment system so more people might be eligible in the future. Today, Alaska Republican Sarah Palin became the latest in a string of governors to say they don't want that money. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Governor Palin says she's leaving around $300 million on the table because it doesn't create private sector jobs or invigorate the economy. One thing Alaska won't do as a result, expand unemployment insurance to reach more people.
Well, we applaud her for that stance.
That's Alaska Chamber of Commerce President Wayne Stevens. Even though Alaska's unemployment rate is nearly 8%, he says the state's unemployment trust fund is flush. Some states, though, are running out of money, and all they have to do to get hundreds of millions of federal dollars to pay benefits is expand eligibility.
Right now, less than 4 in 10 unemployed workers collect state unemployment benefits.
Maurice Emsalem is policy director at the National Employment Law Project.
The types of workers who are a big part of the labor market right now, low-wage workers, part-time workers, women workers, the long-term unemployed.
Maybe they didn't work enough hours or make enough in the last quarter or left to care for a family member. The stimulus money requires making more of these workers eligible, which seems like a bad idea to Renee Baker of the National Federation of Independent Business in Louisiana. She says more people on the rolls could mean higher payroll taxes for businesses.
And expanding it for part-time workers, it's very concerning because it's how do you even know who all is going to qualify?
Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal shares Baker's concern. He's turned down $100 million so far. Republican governors in Texas and South Carolina have also said no thanks. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, you can now officially set aside all your worries over making sure environmental products you buy are actually good for the environment. Next week, Good Housekeeping magazine is going to announce a green Good Housekeeping seal of approval. That clearly means the sustainability movement has hit the big time, even if many of us are pretty green at being green. We sent Cash Peters to a convention that's designed to help us learn how.
Years ago, the idea of a green expo would have been considered flaky and fringe. Now, though, well, it's still a bit flaky, but, you know, less. Actress and green person, Mariela Hemingway.
In the past, it's been a movement of those people. They eat granola and they're, you know, they're just different from us. And the fact of the matter is, I think people really are concerned with, you know, their parks and their environment and their homes. But it's all overwhelming to them.
Overwhelming is right. The Go Green Expo was stuffed to the rafters with bamboo towels and hemp this and hemp that and geeky men telling you why you should ionize your tap water.
So ionization breaks the clusters up and makes them into small little clusters or small little cells of water. Therefore, your cells get, the water gets to the cells, taking all of the nutrition and oxygen.
Yes, I see. I mean, that's the problem right there. To the rest of us, eco-friendly people sound like whacked-out brainiacs.
I'm on Planet Green right now.
She sure was. And on Planet Green, everything's different. Lisa Fenton was promoting an electric car. Top speed? 35 miles an hour. That's two notches up from a skateboard. And it's ugly.
I don't think so. We've had a lot of people come by here today, and they say, cute, it's cute.
Yeah, those are people with no taste.
Cute. You don't think this is great?
I don't, actually. I think it's really horrible.
I guess you don't like a Volkswagen either.
You are psychic.
We are at that moment, a critical moment in the green energy industry, where it's kind of like the first computers. They were junk. They were absolute junk. You couldn't do anything with them. They didn't even spell check. But then suddenly there was a moment where computers became something that everyone can use.
That's Josh Tickell, director of the eco movie Fuel, which I've not seen. But is it possible, do you think, that regular folks say they care about saving the planet, but don't really?
It's not for lack of caring. It's for lack of knowing what to do.
Okay, it's not that they don't care. They are lazy and indifferent.
I actually don't
and
even...
And boring. And indolent.
And indolent. I actually don't think that they're lazy. I think that there is a lack of basic fundamental education on what to do.
And you know what they want us to do? Go back to the land. Boise Thomas has an ecology show on TV, which, needless to say, I've not seen.
The big push for me is farming. I think everybody needs to get their fingers dirty again, get dirt under their fingernails, start growing their own food, and start getting back in touch with the planet.
See, it horrifies me, the idea of getting my fingers dirty.
Well, you should...
Do you know how much this manicure costs?
Well, you should get involved with people who do, and then maybe you can just wash down the shovels or something.
Oh, yeah, you can see me washing down shovels, right? But I have to admit, there's something very exciting and new about all this. I really got sucked in. Bradford Rand, the guy behind the expo, is like a modern-day Noah, and the tree huggers are helping him build an ark.
This could be the green revolution. This could be a pivotal point where we actually make a stand against those naysayers that say, of course, global warming is a myth. I guess when they develop lung cancer or drink poisonous water, maybe then they'll realize that we were right.
Yike. But finally, back to lovely Marielle Hemingway. Give me one step, Marielle, I said, that will get me started and on the road to...
I'm on Planet Green right now.
Anywhere other than where she is. What can I do?
Change your breakfast. Start with that. Change something small.
Do you know what I have for breakfast?
Yeah, I don't know.
Hemp.
You had hemp seeds.
I have hemp every morning.
Actually, you know what? I love hemp seeds. They're nutty.
Like yourself, really?
Yeah, kind of like me.
She thought I was joking. In Los Angeles, I'm Cash Peters for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, a couple of them actually, the Congressional Budget Office confirmed this morning what most of us probably suspected, that it is going to be really expensive to get the economy back on track. The CBO says President Obama's 10-year budget is going to produce nearly $10 trillion in combined annual deficits. And this also, Steve Rattner, the guy running the president's automotive task force, says he can't rule out General Motors and Chrysler asking for more money to stay out of Chapter 11. That'd be bankruptcy, of course. Lots more money, perhaps. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday afternoon. Today, the Dow slipped 122 points, 1 2/3%, ended at 72.78. The NASDAQ slipped 26 points, 1 3/4%, closed at 14.57. The S&P 500 lost 15 points, nearly 2%, closed at 7.68. For the week, though, up was the word, more than 1% on the NASDAQ and the S&P, 3/4% on the Dow. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste West, and the executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, not too hot, not too cold, getting banking regulation just right.
You have to balance the need to protect the consumers and the safety and soundness of the system without stifling the creativity, the innovation, the free flow of capital, all the hallmarks of capitalism.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.